Number of people have been injured at Terminal 3 in the past half hour. More on that as we get it. In other news, a couple whose bodies were found buried in a back garden were shot. It's over 3 weeks since the remains were discovered in Mansfield in Nottinghamshire. Matt Steele has more.
The bodies still haven't been formally identified, but pathologists have revealed the man and woman died from gunshot wounds. Detectives believe they're William and Patricia Witcherly, who lived in the house in the 90s, and neighbours say vanished suddenly. Two people are being questioned after they were arrested in London yesterday. It's understood they're the couple's daughter and son-in-law.
Emails which suggest News of the World reporters paid public officials for information and hacked voicemails have been shown to the jury in the phone hacking trial. Eight people deny the charges against them at the Old Bailey. A court's heard of an email exchange about George Best's son Callum, in which Andy Coulson told a fellow defendant to do his phone. People are being told to postpone having fireworks parties in their back gardens tonight. Firefighters in England and Wales are going on strike and will walk out between 6:30 and 11 o'clock. Fire and Rescue Minister Brandon Lewis believes staff have no reason to strike.
FBU have chosen a really bad way to go forward. When you're negotiating and when the employees themselves are saying they want to carry on working through the details of this, to walk away and call a strike just seems completely inappropriate, very disappointing.
Meanwhile, a planned strike on Monday by workers in hundreds of Crown post offices has been called off. The Royal Bank of Scotland says it expects to make a substantial loss this year. Earlier, RBS confirmed it will create a so-called internal bank to ring-fence £38 billion of toxic assets. And in football, Hibernian have announced that manager Pat Felnan has left the club. It's after Hibs made a terrible start to the season, including losing to rivals Hearts on Wednesday. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
And just imagine if there were no democracy in Britain, if banks simply funneled limitless supplies of cash into whatever company board they wanted to succeed, including political parties, even funding opposition groups to replace foreign leaders they don't like, such as the Syrian National Council. If entire disciplines such as economics and journalism were funded by those banks and corporations, only if they supported the banks. Also, plenty of paranoia being spread around by the mainstream press about Iran and Syria. But what about the US Secretary of State, who's a member of something called the Brotherhood of Death? A British professor gives us an unedited lowdown. The next big Snowden story, you heard it here first. Have Microsoft and other US telecoms and software giants been promising everyone that their data is secure and then illegally handing it all over to the NSA? Plus, Occupy London activist Laurie Love is arrested for hacking NASA and the US Army websites by Britain's FBI. They say he's a terrorist. Why didn't the national press mention his Occupy connection in Monday's news story? Laurie's parents both work in a Suffolk prison, educating and administering to jailed inmates. He hasn't broken any British laws. So is the National Crime Agency, the new National Crime Agency, there to enforce British law or American law? Do we pay their wages for them to enforce the US law in Britain? Have they themselves broken British law only a month after they were formed? Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 13, wetter on Saturday, sunnier on Sunday with some gusty winds. Next week, highs 13 Celsius, sunny at the beginning and end of the week, but wet and windy in between. Next weekend, 9th and 10th of November, highs of 13 Celsius, sunshine and showers again next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Horfield, Claire Hiscott. Hi, Claire, and welcome to Drive
Good
Time.
Good evening. Delighted to be here.
Now, Claire, you just became a councillor this year in May. You took over from the Liberal Democrats in Horfield. How did you manage that? How did you actually steal the seat from them?
Well, somebody gave me a very lovely piece of advice, which is talk to people. And if you talk to people, you understand what the issues are in the locality, and if you engage with people, then you win them over.
Okay.
And they understand what you're there for.
Well, that's certainly a good idea to be talking. But what are the issues in Horfield? One of the things I know about is the planned redevelopment up there, which people are saying may suck a big Sainsbury's may suck away, or a supermarket, a lot of the trade from Gloucester Road.
Well, I think, yes, the jury's out on that one. I think Sainsbury's is actually probably one of the best offers that Bristol Rovers got for the Memorial ground. It won't just be a supermarket, it's going to be some affordable housing there, some really good landscaping. It's going to improve the area greatly and get rid of all that nasty traffic, which residents have every match day.
Well, I don't, I personally,
so it's 50-50.
Don't like this word affordable housing, because I can't afford it and hardly anyone can afford it. A lot of it is really expensive, even though it's supposed to be affordable. I realise that, you know, the idea is that people can afford it, but often they can't. Anyway, what about you personally? Why the Conservative Party? Why not one of the other parties?
Well, I looked at them all and I decided to go with the one that I disagreed with least, which is one way of going about it. It's a very broad church, the Conservative Party, which means that I felt that I was probably most comfortable there.
The only thing, of course, with the Conservative Party, just generally the name Conservative, means we're trying to keep things the same.
At the moment,
they seem to be changing everything. Big changes to the National Health Service, all sorts of privatisations going on. So they can't really call it a Conservative Party anymore.
Well, it's a very old name, isn't it? Just as Labour is an old name, about, you know, and what does that conjure up to people? Perhaps we just ought to call ourselves the Blue Team.
Is that really what it's about now, do you think? That some of the original ideals of these parties have gone by the wayside and it's really just a kind of team sport?
Sometimes it gets to look like team sport, doesn't it? I think the Conservative Party is there for people that have worked hard and want to do well in life, which I think represents a very large amount of the population. Historically, the Conservatives Party's actually been quite a compassionate party, which it doesn't get a lot of credit for now. But we are on the side of the hard-working individual who wants to get on.
But what about the hard-working individual that simply cannot afford to pay bills? Or so many bills, I mean, for example, the most important, I suppose, being energy bills and petrol, these kind of things, rent. You know, these bills are all, petrol's been relatively stable for about a year or so. But, I mean, actually, the cost of motoring through insurance and things like that is going up. It's nothing to do, really, is it, Claire, with hard work? Because you can work extremely hard and still find it's almost impossible to pay those bills.
You can, and I am one of those people that struggles with their bills. But I know that I am managing my own finance, and most people do want to manage their own finances and do work incredibly hard. I think there are, energy costs are spiralling, which is awful, but if we'd been more energy aware in the last 13 years, we'd have had our own energy sources instead of having to buy them in from abroad, and that's a very large part of the issue.
I mean, there's a load of coal in South Wales.
There is a load of coal.
What about that? Do you buy it that coal is really bad stuff, we mustn't use it?
I think that coal is not bad stuff. I think the way that we process it has been historically bad. My father was part of an oil refinery and BP looking at how to use clean burn coal. It's something that has gone by the wayside. I think perhaps we need to look at the technology. We need to look at all our technologies to ensure that whatever fuel we use, it doesn't pollute the environment.
It's a bit difficult, though, isn't it, with all these fossil
Very
fuels,
difficult.
If not impossible. And even with the nuclear stuff, that leaves a legacy for hundreds of thousands of years of radiation.
Indeed it does, but what do we want to
turn
off our lights?
So which is your energy source of choice, then?
My energy source of choice? Nationally, we definitely need a broad base, so we need to be able to use wind, we need to be able to use wave, we are going to inevitably have to use gas and nuclear and possibly fracking, because our energy needs are going up, and that is the way it is. I don't think any government, red, blue, green, pink, cannot reduce our energy consumption, and that is what we need, energy. And until we don't need energy, we are going to have to face that issue.
Well, we're certainly not going to be...
We're using electricity now.
Well, we are a little bit, a tiny bit, a few watts. But anyway, That's not the end of that subject, because we'll be hearing from the Prime Minister and the Leader of Opposition talking about that in a minute. But finally, on your patch, your ward in Horfield, what are the other issues you think?
My lovely ward of Horfield. We have a big new hospital opening, which is Southmead Hospital, which is actually slap bang in Horfield.
Well, it looks lovely, doesn't it? But it's a private finance initiative, which means that we, the public, have had to pay a lot more through that. We probably wouldn't have had our hospital
under
if it hadn't been.
Yeah, which is a shame, but we do have a shiny new hospital, and I have been elected in May, and I have what I have, and I think it's going to look good. It's on time and it's on budget. It's causing us a few hiccups, but they've been very helpful, and we're trying to mitigate with congestion and parking and things like that, but hopefully it will bring jobs in to the area and raise the area.
Certainly looks nice, even if it was rather expensive.
It's huge.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, a couple of things this week. We've had, first of all, the latest fraud from the City of London. It's almost like every once in a while. Is there anything that this is foreign exchange fraud that Barclays have held their hands up to before they've even been investigated for it, which is amazing, really, that these banking institutions are so magnanimous that rather than be investigated and told off, they hold their hands up and say, yes, we've done it. And I wonder what they're going to say that about next. But this is foreign exchange this time.
Yeah, well, as you know, in previous shows on this show, Tony, we've had Fraud Squad officer Rowan Bosworth Davis, who worked for the Met Fraud Squad for 12 years, was involved in the Blue Arrow trial in 1993. And he has basically said on this show, as you know, that what most of the standard procedures of the City of London are in fact fraudulent. And, of course, ultimately, we could solve our deficit problem by arresting the fraudsters and seizing their assets. And that is not...
Well, how's that going to solve any problems?
It's not going to... First of all, you solve your deficit problem because you seize the assets of the people who've defrauded you. Secondly, of course, you then set down a benchmark for a generation that we're not going to put up with people thieving other people's money. And that's what we tell 17-year-olds who are being sent to young offenders institutions. And, of course, he left the fraud squad because he said eventually it became clear that the senior people in government were not going to allow us to pursue what needed to be pursued in terms of catching these people. And Peter Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US economist, he's an academic economist in Texas, and he's saying we're never going to sort this out in the US until we start putting these senior people in prison. And, of course, we saw HSBC were accused of money laundering for the Mexican
cartels. Well, they were not quite convicted, but they paid a massive fine, didn't they?
But an institution paying a fine means that the institution pays a fine. It doesn't mean what should happen is the CEOs, Lord Green in this case, should have been sent to prison, his assets should have been seized. Now, this may seem extreme, but, of course, ultimately, this is a very extreme situation when the international financial system has become systematically fraudulent. That is a really serious situation. It's going to crash as a result of that, and millions of people all over the world are going to lose their jobs, and as a result of that, all sorts of social conflict is going to break out. That is coming round the corner. Now, whoever the government is in 2 years' time, that's the situation they're going to be dealing with.
The other thing this week is that we've heard that the Royal Bank of Scotland has decided it's not going to separate, as was recommended by Andy Tyrie's committee. The banking committee said that they wanted the government banks, which they do control, they have the major share in those, they want RBS and Lloyds to completely separate the high street retail banking side from the investment banking side. And that is now not going to happen, they've said, with Royal Bank of Scotland.
There's a slight conceptual confusion there. Separating retail banking from investment banking is a perfectly sensible idea, and Andy Tyrie's committee has actually done a very good job of pushing for that. But of course that's not going to happen, not here or in the US. It used to be illegal under the Glass-Steagall Act until 1993, when it was overturned during the Clinton administration in the US. What they're talking about is having a bad bank which is full of toxic assets and a good bank which is full of supposedly not toxic assets. So these are two separate things, Tony. Do you see what I mean? They're not the same thing. Incidentally, Andy Tyrie's committee has done a pretty good job. Rowan Bosworth Davis submitted a report to that committee. And as he said, they said you'll have to edit it. And he said, well, why have I got to edit it? So you can't accuse them all of being fraudsters. He said, yes, I can. I'm a fraud squad officer, and I've investigated these people. They are fraudulent. Now, I think Andy Tyrie, in fact, has actually done a reasonable job, in my view, of saying what needs to be done. but of course he's up against massive vested interests. Now, exactly the same with Labour.
What we're hearing today is the Royal Bank of Scotland is going to create this internal bad bank with £38 billion of problem assets. Rather than separating it, separating the two, they're going to keep that within themselves. Now, is this what's going to, you say, kill them off in however many months or years' time? This £38 billion of problem assets is simply going to
destroy the bank? All of the banks are essentially engaged in fraudulent accounting because they are marking to magic a lot of the stuff they're holding on their books. A lot of their derivatives contracts are worth X, but in actual fact they're not worth X, they're worth a fraction of X, but they're allowed to count it as assets on their balance sheets as if they were at full price. But if they went to the market and tried to sell that security, it wouldn't fetch anything like that amount of money. And we've all been colluding in this, and governments have been colluding in this as well, because if you really were to go through the books with a fine tooth comb, the banking system would collapse, and nobody wants that, or at least that's not what the mainstream wants.
So George,
ultimately, of course, if you carry on like that, it collapses anyway.
George Osborne's going along with this. Today's a defining day for our organisation, said RBS Chief Executive Ross McEwan on Radio 4's Today programme. He called these bad assets a complete distraction. Our objective is to make a good bank out of this so that he, talking about George Osborne, has a great asset to sell. Now, they're going to try and sell this back to the public with all these bad assets.
Well, that's precisely what's wrong with it. Any member of the public who bought those shares in that bank with all that toxic stuff on the books would be a fool, wouldn't they? That's the problem.
Okay, on to look at some of the news then. David Cameron says Unite's leveraging allegations are shocking. The Prime Minister's described allegations that Unite union members targeted the homes of Grangemouth refinery managers as quite shocking. The row follows claims by Ineos director that a mob was sent by Unite to his home to intimidate him during the recent dispute. Martin, are you proud of your Labour Party colleagues here
As Ed Miliband says here, and I will quote him, he's against any intimidatory tactics in any situation, and I think that's the most important thing. But we need to ascertain what's exactly happened here. What is legitimate process and what isn't? Are you allowed to go and protest outside the house of a minister?
The police were called here.
Yes, well, the police will be called to a protest, won't they? Because they're there to make the police will be called to make sure that everybody behaves themselves.
But of course, the police wouldn't be called if they weren't intimidating people, would they?
No, well, people went round to Michael Heseltine's house, I seem to remember, at one stage, and protested on his lawn against something that he was doing. Now, is that legitimate or is it not legitimate? I think people have got to decide what the limits are here. And of course,
what do you think the limits are?
I think as long as people are not actually hurting anybody else and they're not damaging property, then as long as they're acting peacefully, then with the police in attendance.
So what if they come into your hallway and don't come into your living room? Is that all right?
Yes, I mean, ultimately, we've got to be robust about this. The right to protest is quite important. We can't just be got rid of by the stroke of a pen.
So yes, it is okay if they come into your hallway.
As long as it's got to be done within a reasonable, civilised fashion.
Okay, Claire.
But I think the issue is that are you protesting against a company or against a person? And this has become personal. And bullying is not really acceptable, is it? Would you, if you work for a company, you have a company view, you have a right to protest against that company. I'm not sure you have a right to then protest against those employers' families to come to their house. If Ineos are upsetting you, go and protest against Ineos.
I mean, what if the children, for example, having to come home from school through a mob outside the house and come down the path?
Well, let's put another question here. The Conservatives brought through trade union laws in the 1980s, which were against what they called secondary action. Now, that means you're only allowed to protest against the company that or strike against the company that employs you. Now, in actual fact, that outlaws something which is accepted all in the rest of Europe, which is called solidarity action. So, for example, during the miners' strike, it was impossible legally for railway workers to refuse to carry coal because they were not in dispute with the coal board. Now, that's the situation in Britain, but it's not the situation in places like Greece, where, for example, the unions will call a general strike, for example, against government policy. Mm. You can't do that legally in Britain.
But that's not attacking somebody's house, is it? It's
no,
not camping on their lawn.
Well,
if I If Mr. Miliband upsets me, do I go and camp outside his house in Primrose Hill? No, I don't. I use the ballot box and I use constructive dialogue.
But Claire, there is another aspect to this, and that is that one of the unions are saying is that what happens is that these people are making decisions in the boardrooms and then going back to suburbia as if they personally aren't responsible for them. They can't hide behind this kind of corporate front.
Well, Unite have had an awful long time to negotiate with INEOS, and it looks as though they then climbed down very quickly. So negotiation is where it's at, and negotiation is what should have succeeded and didn't. You cannot then resort to mob tactics of bullying.
Martin, isn't this been very embarrassing for Unite and for the Labour Party?
Well, I think there's a lot of different issues here. I mean, this is the sort of industry which should in fact be in the public sector. It's a crucial infrastructure.
Well,
it's never been, has it?
Oil refineries have never been. Even in 1944 with the most left-wing government ever.
In Norway, where they have their own.
Norway.
Hang on a minute. It's a state-run company in Norway. Statoil is run by the government, and it's always been run by the government, and therefore it would be a government issue. We in this country, over many years, have put all of this into the private sector. Now, I'm totally opposed to intimidatory tactics, but on the other hand, I think we've got a robust attitude towards protest. For example, is it okay for people to stand outside Greenham Common and try and block lorries? The answer is, to my mind, yes, but the police will arrest you. And we've got to develop a fairly thick skin about protest.
But what about the effect?
I think we can protest very effectively in this country. You see marches all the time. You see Trafalgar Square full of people saying what they want to say. There is a big difference between protest and intimidation.
There is, but...
And if you don't get your way, you can't just resort to intimidation. That is not a constructive society.
Martin, the main aspect here, I think, is bringing somebody's family in on this, which is what's been happening by going to these people's homes.
Well, I've protested against my employers previously, and because they were small employers, I did go around to their homes because that's the place to find them. Now, of course, I didn't, in fact, intimidate them. I just stood there holding a sign saying, "I'm not happy with what you've done to me." I didn't do anything.
But they might find that intimidating.
Well, I'm afraid I'm standing on the pavement, which belongs as much to me as it belongs to them. As long as I'm not on their lawn, I'm afraid the road doesn't belong to them.
Claire, how do you answer this business the union are saying that these decisions have massively affected the lives of thousands of workers, and yet these people hide behind this corporate front using the company INEOS as a kind of so that they personally don't have to take any responsibility? They can then run off to suburbia.
My understanding is that Grangemouth was losing an awful lot of money every month, and if any sensible business looks at how it's running its company, if it's losing money. Yes, there are thousands of people affected, and yes, everybody needs to take responsibility, but is it not better to restructure in order to keep a company going than to refuse to change, which was the Unite's position initially, and close something down? I think Unite's are there to look after their workforce and the people that they represent. They didn't do a very good job. Most people in the public sector have had to have their conditions of work looked at. Lots of pensions have had to be rejigged because we are where we are. And Unite have seemed that they just want to carry on with no change. That was impossible. You can't run a company losing millions and millions of pounds. And I think, yes, they probably could have been more cooperative. I think that perhaps the dialogue just broke down because of the intransigence of the unions. It was a very sad day when we heard that it was going to close. And I'm very glad now that INEOS have saved the plant, because Unite have had to climb down. Better to have a job with a smaller pension or a different pension than no job at all.
But, I mean,
Do
you accept that it's quite intimidating for your employer to come along to you and say, by the way, we're imposing a new contract of you, less pay, you have to work longer hours?
Yes, I've just experienced that myself, and nobody jumps up and down for me. And
are you in a union?
And I was in a union. I'm not in a union now. Everybody, there's lots of people in the public sector have had their contracts renegotiated. I'm a pharmacist. It's a good profession, but you know, we're taking pay cuts too. And it's take a pay cut because we've all been living beyond our means, or don't have a job. And it is heartbreaking, and we've all got to readjust, but perhaps we were all living beyond our means and expecting more than we could afford.
Well, staying on the energy topic from the refinery, we go to up in Grangemouth, we go to Westminster now, and with Ed Miliband and David Cameron discussing the wholesale energy prices, which it seems have been going up very little, although the retail prices have been going up far, far more.
Comes here every week and attacks Tory policy. He goes home and he adopts Tory policy to help his own family.
Mr. Speaker, the only thing people need to do if they want somebody to stand up against the energy companies, they need to switch the Prime Minister, and that is what they know. Now, as the unofficial spokesman for the energy companies, maybe he can answer the question that they couldn't answer yesterday. Can he explain why, when wholesale prices have hardly moved since a year ago, retail prices are rising by around 10%?
Because we need both competition and rolling back the costs of charges. But look, switching is part of competition. And the company that he switched to has this to say about his energy freeze. Let's listen to the people providing his energy. They said this: a policy like this is potentially problematic for an independent provider. Bluntly, it could put me under. So that is his policy, not listening to the people providing his energy, but having less choice, less competition, higher prices. It's the same old Labour.
Yes, the same old Labour, Martin. What is going on here? Because the energy companies seem clearly to have been putting up prices far more than they need to. Wholesale prices only going up a couple of percent, and yet 10% or so being the norm for the price that we have to pay.
Yeah, well, I mean, things about price controls are what John Major was suggesting, a windfall tax. My position is quite simple. This industry should not be in the private sector. It should never have been privatised in the first place. We are now facing the consequences of misconceived policies put in place 20 years ago. There is no real competition in an oligopoly. It's chapter 3 of your economics textbook. When you have 6 firms in an industry, or even 8 firms in an industry, that is not a competitive market. It's an imperfectly competitive market, and it leads to collusive pricing strategies by the firms concerned, which is why in the 1940s, these industries were placed in the public sector in the first place, which is where they should be now, as they are in Norway.
Claire. Unfortunately, Labour did have 13 years to reverse that and chose not to.
Indeed.
Claire, the whole business of switching for many people seems a bit pointless, and this is one of the reasons people don't do it, is because you're virtually dealing with a cartel here. There's not a lot of difference between the different prices. There's a lot of confusion marketing where you can go on to one tariff and you can't compare tariffs. Why should anybody switch if actually there isn't any real competition?
Well, there is competition because I have actually had to sort this out. I was forced to sort it out in the last couple of days. And there is competition, and you do have to look very carefully at what they're offering. That's why the government have reduced the number of tariffs that they can offer, because everything was getting so complex.
So who would you advise people to switch to then? You know, please help here.
Well, I think you need to look at your own usage. You need to look at what you currently pay. You need to look at every company. I've just fixed mine because I just need to know what I'm paying. But that might not be right for everybody. You do have to look at your energy usage. You there are tariffs for people over 55. There's all sorts of things that you do have to look at. And as onerous as it is, I do encourage everybody listening, look at your energy prices. Don't put your head in the sand.
But it's a headache, isn't it?
It's a great headache. You know, it's you don't want to have to buying do a this. Mobile phone, isn't it? But we all do it.
Yes, but if you're doing this, for example, with energy prices, it seems like sort of a year later, there's another deal around.
It all changes.
Why not nationalise it? I mean, we were watching Question Time on BBC One last night. There was a massive support in the audience for nationalisation when someone suggested it. A big applause from the audience. I mean, that would essentially mean that we don't have any of this messing around between another provider, and also that electricity is then provided at cost, not with shareholders taking a cut.
Yes, but you see that we do swing bosses. As the public. We always swing from wanting things either in the public sector or in the private sector, and we do swing, but I think realistically we usually want something in the middle. We had a problem with it being in the private sector. That's why we did sell off various companies, because of productivity was not high when industries were nationalised. Now we've gone over to the private sector, and now we are upset about the amount of profit they make, but they are much more productive. And we do swing. We swing in our politics all the time. And I have to say this, that the extreme of any ideology usually is stupidity. And probably it would be lovely if we could run a nationalised industry productively and to a profit. It hasn't been the case in the last 30 years that I can remember. And so we now have a private sector, and we do have competition. I would love to see more competition. But you have a choice of the big six, but if you shop around, there are other places to go in industry.
Yes, well, also, we had Ed Miliband accusing David Cameron this week of just being a public relations man for the energy companies. I mean, what do you think of that, Claire? Because
Mr. Miliband and Mr. Cameron, they love to chuck various accusations.
But he was a public relations man, wasn't he?
He was a PR man, but what was Mr. Miliband? Not very much, just a politician. And so he's exactly the same. You know, Ed's going to push his little brand of Labour as much as Mr. Cameron's going to push the blue brand.
Martin, well, this idea of you know, Prime Minister's questions being kind of PR for the energy industry, it doesn't seem like this debate is really being taken on, does it?
Well, you know my view of Prime Minister's questions. We have it on every week, and I just think it's a useless Punch and Judy exercise by and large. Incidentally, of course, during the 1950s, we used to have nationalised industries, and we had a Conservative government, and there was a consensus about the kind of mixed economy that we all agreed with. And in actual fact, if we all start moving back in a direction, I think the mistakes that have been made in running capitalism in the last 10 years ought to be making those who are in favour of the market think twice. And of course, there is a critique to be made of things being run by the government as well.
So, can I ask you?
You know, we should be able to try and find common ground on this.
We should. So, Martin, can you tell me then that why in the 13 years of a Labour government did you not renationalise?
Well, it wasn't me in charge.
No, I know, but Labour in general, why did they not renounce?
What we were being told as activists was that we've got priorities to deal with when we get to power, and renationalising these industries, which might be desirable or might not, is not our top priority. Now, although if you look
they
at...
They had 13 years.
I know, but don't forget also...
That's a long time.
It's true, but don't forget that the right wing of the Labour Party don't believe in nationalisation anyway. I'm on the left wing and I do, but the right wing don't. So there was an argument within. So the supporters of Mr. Blair and Mr. Mandelson don't believe in nationalisation, but they're in the same party as
okay.
me and I do.
The next privatisation, apart from the uranium industry, I don't know if you know that, but that's going to be one of the next ones. Scariest thing in the world to privatise that and let anybody buy up our uranium and plutonium. But anyway, that's coming along soon. But before that, the proposal is the privatisation of the probation service, which was brought up by Sian James, MP, at Question Time.
Sian James!
I'm very surprised that the Prime Minister is... prepared to gamble along with the Justice Minister on his proposals for the probation service, especially in light of the early tests and trials actually being called to a halt. Is he prepared to gamble especially with the lives and the daily safety of my constituents and other people in this country, and will his gambling luck hold out?
What we want with the probation service is a service that is much more focused on getting results, on stopping reoffending, and also making sure that we give people services in terms of rehabilitation from the moment that they leave prison. That doesn't happen today. But it is interesting, Mr. Speaker, 26 minutes past 12 and not one question from Labour on the economy. They've got nothing to say. They've got nothing to offer. They are embarrassed that prediction after prediction was completely wrong.
Hey, stop!
Well, that's this idea of probation service being privatised, Claire, is a little bit worrying, isn't it? Because you've got paedophiles and murderers, and their rehabilitation into society is quite important. Is it going to really be a good idea to hand that job over to G4S and Serco, people who've already been shown to, you know, basically be running at certain occasions anyway fraudulent businesses?
Well, I do think it's a very interesting and difficult question. I don't think I'm necessarily best placed to answer it because I'm not an expert in the prison service or probation. I would be cautious. However, I think if we look at other countries, they do have privatised services. I think the key issue is that we get the best to rehabilitate criminals. I think when you are released, the main thing that you need is support.
But the motivation,
I'm not quite sure which is the best way about it. I'm not an expert. I really...
The motivation here, surely, though, Martin, is it's about price. This is about we want a cheap probation service, not about the best probation service.
Well, don't forget the probation service itself. These are the people who have been doing it for years. And you could argue, well, you've been doing it for years, but we want to improve what you're doing, so we're going to shake you up. But you're going to lose a lot of the skill and knowledge that those people have developed over the years by being, you know, the public probation service. And I would argue that things like prisons and where you're taking away people's liberty and it's, you know, that should be above profit taking, basically. I mean, we are talking, as you say, about having groups like G4S in charge of it, who have demonstrably failed, for example, over the Olympic Games.
Okay, and another big problem is youth unemployment. This was brought up by Lucy Powell at Prime Minister's Questions.
Lucy Powell.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I've got a question on the economy for the Prime Minister. Prime Minister agree with his own advisers that the government's youth contract is failing to tackle, and I quote, the appallingly high levels of youth unemployment.
What we've seen with the youth contract is thousands of young people getting work through our work experience scheme. It has been more successful than the Future Jobs Fund, but has cost six times as little. Through the youth contract, we've also seen over 20,000 young people get work opportunities. That's why we see the youth claimant count coming down so rapidly in our country. There is still far more to do to get young people into work, but the fact that we have backed over 1.5 million apprenticeships is a sign about how much we care about getting young people back to work.
Claire Hiscott, Conservative from Horfield. What are your thoughts about youth unemployment? Because this is a massive, it's increased massively
it's
over the
tragic.
Last 4 or 5 years. What is the government actually going to do about it?
I think the way that we have addressed apprenticeships, fantastic. You know, what we really need to do is make sure that our young people are highly educated. And that's been one of our big problems, is we have people coming out of school without the basic qualifications of maths and English. And when they go for a job, they're not prepared. I think that's heartbreaking. I've recruited people before. I look at the way they present themselves, their achievements so far, and we've let them down. The education system has let so many people down.
But there simply aren't enough jobs for these young people.
Well, we do have an interesting demographic now. We have people working longer because they are weller for longer. Everybody is so much more healthy. They will work for longer, and we have an increasing population. It is something that the entire EU has got to deal with. I think we're dealing with it very well in this country by bringing in things like apprenticeships, which, you know, were very difficult to come by a few years ago. And what we are looking to do is to increase the skill set of people coming out of school, and that puts them in a much better position. It is difficult, but I think we're doing a good job at the moment. Long way to go, however.
It's the government's own advisers that have said that this government's flagship scheme to tackle youth unemployment, Martin, has been branded a failure.
Well, I mean, it's all apple pie and motherhood, isn't it? I mean, the fact of the matter is...
But this is our future. No, I mean, you can't afford to throw young people's employment away.
We all agree that, but the real problem is the macroeconomic failures, and the deregulation of the city in the 1980s has turned out to be an absolute international disaster. It's possibly going to cause a third world war. That's how bad it is. And talking about... we've got more educated people than ever... And in fact, qualifications have actually improved, but that doesn't solve the problem if there isn't the demand in the economy for these young people. And we haven't had the proper crash yet. The state stepped in 2008, let's remind everybody, and rescued the private financial system. If the state all over the world hadn't stepped in to rescue the private financial system, we'd be in a far worse position than we are now.
The Labour Party is proposing a real jobs guarantee to 18 to 24-year-olds. Well, so that is not, rather than spending the £1 billion this has cost so far, the youth contract, on organisations which try and help young people get into work, actually directly that money going to pay for jobs for young
people.
Ultimately,
that's what happened in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, is that the government became the employer of last resort. And it was called the New Deal in the United States. Now, what's happened, because of the political power of a criminal financial elite, these kind of options are not on the table. So we've all got to talk in terms of, let's try and deal with a situation that we shouldn't be in the first place. But the thing about an international crisis like this is it will eventually force onto the agenda real questions about the distribution of wealth and power, the real distribution of wealth and
Claire,
power.
Claire, what have you got to say to young people out there who are just desperately after jobs, are finding that they simply can't get them? I mean, I know several who've applied for jobs, doing things like that, working at Asda, things like that, and they can't even get those jobs.
I know, and my daughter has even tried to get a Saturday job, and
well educated, perfectly capable.
We are still recovering from a recession. We are growing, but we're still recovering. And I'd say, if you are trying to get a job out there, keep going, keep applying. Make sure that you are the best you can be. Present yourself. You know, it's a competition, and as heartbreaking as it is, you have to try your very best to show every employer why you should get the job.
Okay, someone that's been doing recruiting, what are your two top tips?
My two top tips are: come well presented, look as though you've had a shower. You'd be surprised at what I've experienced. And you know, when you present your CV or you post it in, make sure you've checked it, double checked it. Make sure that you have researched the company that you are going to ask for a job from. It's no good if you go in and the employer says, "So, why do you want to work for Blogs and Co?" and you say, "Well, I don't know."
Okay, thanks. Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to take a democracy health check this week, to ask you what you think about the health of our democracy.
Do you vote in the national and local elections?
No, I think because they're all much of a muchness now. There's no difference between any of the parties anymore, and I don't think they do the community any good. They don't listen to the people of this country.
I don't vote either. I think they look after the rich and forget all the poor.
The reason I don't vote is I'm not really familiar with the government policies. Still think, because I'm young, it's quite hard to get on with things, so I'm not all that happy with them generally. Difficult, it's almost like a puzzle that can't be solved, like things with employment and stuff. If there was jobs out there, I presume the employers would employ people, but there's not.
Yes, I do, because democracy is important. If you don't vote, then you don't get the chance to say you don't like what's happening. I think they're doing quite a good job. I unfortunately voted Liberal Democrat last time and totally let down by them joining the Tories, so we'll be voting them out this time around.
No, I think they're all exactly the same, and I think their only aim is just to promise what they want to get into power, and then when they're in power, that's it. So it doesn't really matter if you do vote or not, it's not really much difference, to be honest.
Yes, I vote in the national analog elections. Yeah, it's important that we have a lively discourse, and so I don't always agree what goes on, but I think we're well represented and the system is working. I know a lot of people are dissatisfied with it, but yeah.
Is Britain a democracy?
I think the pretense is a democracy, but I don't think it is. The government are getting involved in too many things that they shouldn't be getting involved in, like kids having holidays in school terms and what we can and can't eat, how we drive around the country, whether we use public transport or cars. It's verging on a dictatorship, which I don't think is very good for the country at all. To work with the people of the city, not just the rich of any city, they don't do a lot for the elderly and unemployed people. Again, the pretense is that they do. There's all this help for all these different groups, but there isn't. If there was help, we wouldn't have a load of unemployed, and we wouldn't have old age people in homes, you know, being abused and things like that. There's no help. I think they like to think that they're helping, but they're not.
And the government policies and stuff like that, as far as democracy goes, it's a bit out of fashion now. Like, last job I had, it was helping people fill out passport forms through a call centre, and they don't really need the help. It's quite straightforward. But at the end of the day, we have to create employment. I mean, it's like council tax. It might be a lot for some people. It might be 10%, £1,000 of £10,000. And it just makes you wonder why the government are almost like a mafia, and they can collect this money from everybody or threaten to break into their house and take their TV and video if they didn't pay. I know there's ways around it, but it's still a very evil system at the moment. You know, you're under the threat that if you don't comply with these things, if you park here and you're on Job Seekers Lounge, you could be fined £70, £40. You know, there's no real way around it. You could not have enough to eat that week or that month. And I think these days, if there was a democracy, if the democracy did work, then that wouldn't be the case or the situation.
It is a democracy. I mean, people vote. The things are done for the greater good. Sometimes people don't like what's happening. One of the main things about democracy is that it represents everybody, not just the vast majority of people. All of this stuff that's going on now about the Romanians, for example, if we didn't have a democracy, then we'd have a system where they would be being taken out of the country, not allowed in. That's just not right.
No, on the face of it, I think it is, but I think there's some goings on behind the scenes that are a bit underhanded, shall we say.
Definitely. The whole point of a democracy is people have differing opinions, people are going to be dissatisfied with the system. The British love to be unhappy about things.
How do we fix it?
As a hard one, again, I think if somebody that is actually from the poorer classes in a position of authority, we might get something done. While the rich are in charge, they won't do anything for the poorer people of this country.
It's not broken.
Maybe. If they're a lot more open and honest about what they're doing. I don't think we ever will, to be honest. I think it's just been exactly the same historically throughout year in, year out. So I don't think it can be fixed.
It needs to move with the times and develop. It needs to watch the elements of our political system that are trying to move us away from democracy. So if someone's keeping an eye on that, then yes, I think so.
Martin, one of the most common, several people there saying, talking about a pretense of democracy, and some pretty strong words, things like the mafia who can come and beat your door down if you don't do what you're told.
Well, I think there is some truth in that, because of course what happens is the elected system is bolted on to the permanent government, and you know the existence of the economic system.
What do you mean by the permanent government?
Well, the permanent government, coming back to what was mentioned earlier about why didn't the Labour Party renationalise the industries that were privatised in the 13 years they're in power. Now, because if you did that, you'd be taking on the City of London. Now, the City of London is a massively powerful institution. So is the Pentagon. Now, neither the Pentagon nor the City of London, nobody gets to elect the people running. You're supposedly electing the people to run the Pentagon when you vote for the US president. But the Pentagon, the City of London, and Wall Street are in fact calling the shots, and the politicians are largely window dressing. But I think I would take issue with some of those people saying, oh, they're all the same and all the rest of it. That's just lazy thinking. They're not all the same. There is a political debate, but one of the problems is that, especially in a crisis, we're being told what the banks are saying, you can't do this and you can't do that because otherwise we won't lend you the money. And you think, I'm saying, hang on a minute, we just bailed you out. Now we can't get money off you unless we do X, Y, and Z. Now, any government, and especially if we get a Labour government, will be up against these kind of forces. But the same would be true of a Conservative government that was a reforming government.
Claire, we had around about 50-50 yeses and noes as about whether people voted or not. It's not very good. It doesn't show that we've got a healthy democracy, does it? One person saying they voted for the Liberal Democrats and they felt betrayed.
I think everybody's been very disappointed with politics in the last few years. I think after we had the expenses scandal, I think we all thought, gosh, they're all as bad as each other. And it has meant that people have switched off from politics, and that's why I got into politics, because actually normal, ordinary working people need to think about how they want their society run. And I would encourage people out there, you do have a view, you do have an opinion, and you do have a vote. And especially the women out there, you know, we have only had the vote for about 100 years. Goodness me, you use it. Yes, sometimes we make decisions and they're not, you know, somebody looks like a bright and shiny candidate and it doesn't turn out the way we want it, but then we vote them out.
Well, what about what Marty was saying about the permanent government, the city? I mean, we're talking also about some of the large, really massive institutions with revolving doors, with departments like the Ministry of Defence, for example, and the defence industry. These people don't change, do they? So what's the point in voting when the people with the real purse strings, that is the city, not the Treasury, the city, they don't change, do they, when you vote?
No, they don't change, but our laws change, and the attitude that we have can change. So we decide whether we want businesses to flourish in this country, or we decide whether we're going to cause them problems. And
but it's a
big debate for every government.
There are laws against fraud, aren't there? And yet fraud has been going on in the city. LIBOR fraud, money laundering by HSBC. So the law isn't actually being enforced. So what's the point of a law if it's not being enforced?
Well, I mean, we are recovering from Gordon Brown's light touch on the banks. And it is going to take quite a long time to bring it all back into order. But I would say that large companies are not all bad. If we don't have people that are the driving force behind our economy, what do we do? Do we go to communism where we, I don't know, where we all work for the state? We've got to have creativity, we've got to have entrepreneurship, and we've got to have businesses. Businesses employ people. We're not all businessmen, but we do need them. They're not all nasty.
Okay, 8 years on, the trial of the alleged perpetrators begins in November 2005, within months of the guilty pleas resulting from Operation Glade. The Metropolitan Police Service was notified of irregularities with the telephone voicemails of members of the royal household. That was November 2005, the beginning of the phone hacking scandal. The police investigation closed down several times, but this week we have in court Rebecca Brooks, Andy Coulson and several others who have pleaded not guilty to phone hacking. Martin Summers, interesting case this.
Yes, well, I mean, it's again, we're talking that there are two kinds of power, aren't there? There's elected power, and that's what I call it, what I might call sixth form politics. It's about who gets elected. And then there's unelected power, the power of people like Mr. Murdoch, the power of people like the Bernie Madoff in the US. That's not an argument against democracy. It's just pointing out that in the real world, power is not always exercised by politicians.
Well,
are largely factotums.
Well,
people like Murdoch, for example, make and break governments in Australia and here.
He's now being held to account. One of the key witnesses won't be appearing, and that is a guy called Sean Hoare. He died last year, and he was the first person to actually name Andy Coulson, say he was aware of phone hacking by his staff. Hoare was in his mid-40s. He first made his claims in a New York Times investigation into the phone hacking allegations at the News of the World. He told the newspaper not only did Coulson know of the hackings, but also actively encouraged his staff to intercept the calls of celebrities in the pursuit of exclusives. Hoare returned to the spotlight back in July 2011 after he told the New York Times reports that the News of the World were able to use police technology to locate people using their mobile phone signals in exchange for payments to police officers. He said journalists were able to use pinging, which measured the distance between a mobile handset and a number of phone masts, to pinpoint their location. He gave further details about pinging to The Guardian. Also, he described how reporters would ask a news desk executive to obtain the location of a target. Within 15 to 30 minutes, someone on the news desk would come back and say, right, that's where they are. This guy died last year, so he won't be actually at that court case. Also, we had a suspicious death this week. Savills, convicted paedophile BBC driver, was found dead on the day he was due to stand trial for sex crimes uncovered in Operation Yew Tree. This is Yes, David Smith, 67, who was chauffeur to Jimmy Savile and other celebrities. He was the first person to be charged under Operation Yew Tree, the national investigation prompted after claims were made against disgraced TV presenter Jimmy Savile. Well, this guy is an absolutely key person in these paedophile cases, Martin, and he's found dead this week.
Well, there's no point dredging up individual cases, Tony. We're talking in here about the general configuration of power in society. And I think what was being suggested earlier, back in the 1950s, there was a general consensus across the major political forces in Britain, both Labour and Conservative, about the kind of role of the state and the role of the market. And that has actually gone out of the window. And now we've got a situation where private power, the power of people like Mr. Murdoch, who may, of course, be found guilty of criminal offences as a result of what goes on, and if he is found guilty, he should go to prison. It's as simple as that, because people are beginning to believe that there's one law for the rich and one law for the poor. And, of course, that, unfortunately, is correct. But I think the old Conservative Party would never have tolerated that, because we'd been in Second World War as a society, and that had created a kind of mutual trust on both sides of the political divide, which has gone.
Claire,
I think this trial shows that there is not one law for the poor and one law for the rich. I think there is a law for everybody, and everybody has to be called to account.
Well, the trouble is, of course, that many people would want to see someone like Rupert Murdoch in the dock as well. I mean, he's not there, is he? And he was the guy who was profiting from all of the phone hacking.
Well, yes, but profiting is not necessarily... you're not necessarily the perpetrator. This trial's taken a long time to come to fruition. We'll see how it pans out. I think the key people, Rebecca Brooks, Andy Coulson, we will get them to answer the questions, and hopefully we'll get to the truth. I think the major issue, however, has been in journalism, that it's not been in the public interest. Investigative journalism has been an end in itself. It's been about the chase, the scoop. It's been get the story by any means. Hopefully we're going to see that those means are unacceptable.
And I think the other point here is, of course, if you're people around the country don't trust you as a journalist, then maybe you're going to have to go and steal the information. I think that was the case at the News of the World. Anyway, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest. That is Claire Hiscott from Hawthornwall Conservative Councillor. After the news, just imagine if there's no democracy in Britain, if banks simply funneled limitless supplies of cash into whatever company board they wanted to be successful.
93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, there's been a major security incident at LA International Airport. Several shots have been fired by a man with a rifle inside.